Hello and welcome to this week's Green Shoots, a history of Irish football with me, Kieran Kerwin, and Gary Spain. Coming up on this week's podcast, we're with Northern Ireland as they aim to reach the 1982 World Cup in Spain under the new managership of Billy Bingham, and how his influence ushered in a new golden era for Northern Ireland football. Don't forget to share the show on your social media channels to let more people find out about the history and heritage of Irish football. Turn on your notifications on whatever podcast platform you use so that you can get notified straight away when a new episode drops. Now, Northern Ireland football was about to hit its golden age as Billy Bingham became manager in 1980. With him would come some of Northern Ireland football's most cherished nights, and from the moment he became manager, he moulded a team with tenacity and toughness. And Gary, this really is a fantastic period for Northern Ireland football, isn't it?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I don't think there's, I mean, you can talk about 1914, you can talk about 1958, but if you take particularly those 6 years or maybe the 13 years that nearly 14 years Billy Bingham was manager, I think you have to talk about particularly the period from 1980 to 1986 being the most successful of all time. You're talking about two British Championship wins and qualifying for two successive FIFA World Cups. And as it stands, Northern Ireland have only qualified for three. They're still very much in the hunt for 2026. But when you qualify for two out of the three World Cups in that period, I think you have to consider the early 1980s as the most successful period ever.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I know there's often the 1958 World Cup thrown in there as well, but I suppose the consistency of that period of getting to major championships was probably the one that, for me anyway, at least in the debate, that sticks me into the kind of the 80s category a little bit more than 58 being a little bit.
I mean it's not for this podcast, but we will go on and talk about, okay, I talked about 82, 86, but they also came so close to 1984 Euros. I mean, they beat Germany, or West Germany as it was then, home and away.
Wow.
And I mean, so that's how good they were, how successful they were in that period. So it's not just qualifying for the two World Cups. They came so close to Euro 84.
And I suppose as well, it starts with the appointment of Billy Bingham. I don't think there's any doubt, certainly in my mind anyway, that he was a huge driving force in that successful period.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So, I mean, Billy had been manager before. So he had actually left Southport in 1967 to take over as Northern Ireland manager. But he quickly decided it was just a part-time role in those days. And he took on, I think it was Plymouth Argyle. He actually went on to manage Linfield while he was Northern Ireland manager, and won the league, won the Blacksmith Cup, won a couple of other trophies as well. But he had left to manage Greece. And in February 1980, after Denny Blanchflower had resigned, Denny Blanchflower's last game, incidentally, was the win, Jerry Armstrong's goal in the 1-0 win over the Republic in November 1979. But let's gloss over that one. But Denny resigned, and Billy, in February 1980, was the unanimous choice of the IFA to take over. And it was deemed, I mean, I'm just reading back the Belfast Telegraph at the time, because Malcolm Brodie would be for many, many, many years the authority on these things. So he was describing it as a shoe-in that he was going to be accepted, and he was eventually appointed manager in February 1980. And it was probably a strange one in those days, because his World Cup campaign for 1982 actually kicked off in March 1980. For most people, the campaign used to kick off in those days in the following September after the finals of the previous tournament. But because Northern Ireland had missed out in qualification, they kicked off in March 1980 away to Israel in Tel Aviv, which was a real baptism of fire.
Yeah, and just on that, the Billy Bingham thing, I mean, he'd worked under Peter Doherty as well, did he not, when he started it out for Northern Ireland too, and he'd grown up with the Blanchflower brothers as well. So football is very much in his DNA, and perhaps the managerial side of things is very much in his DNA as well.
Yeah, and I mean, the Peter Doherty thing is a good point, because obviously Peter was a legendary player. We talked about him on a previous podcast. He took over as manager for the 58 World Cup squad in qualification. And so Billy had been a player and a legendary player for Northern Ireland. But he had also said, as a player, things were pretty haphazard and it was a bit shambolic until Peter Doherty took over. And as you said, he would have played with Jackie and Danny Blanchflower. Danny in particular, I mean, the legendary Spurs, Northern Ireland player, won the captain Tottenham to the double in 1961. So he would have come through the ranks as a player. He would have seen the downside of being a bit shambolic. I think it's that there were Billy's own, I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but not too much. Peter Doherty obviously changed things completely and made a huge difference. And I'm sure he had a huge influence in Billy, who went on to be an incredibly successful manager and is particularly remembered, though, for shaping Northern Ireland. There was no time for any friendlies, so he had to start off, as I said, in Tel Aviv, March 1980. It was a game I suppose Northern Ireland would have been hoping to win. Israel were a bit of an unknown quantity. I mean, they'd actually won an Asian Cup. They had been playing in Asia and they'd moved into Europe because of the political situation at the time. So going there, Northern Ireland were hoping to win. In reality, they were delighted to finish scoreless. And I mean, Malcolm Brody's comments were, I mean, the floodlights failed when Israel were totally on top and had huge momentum. And I think even Billy Bingham admitted afterwards that if the floodlights hadn't failed, they may not have come away with the scoreless draw. But they defended for their lives. The game, it was actually in doubt as to whether it would restart, but they eventually got the lights going. And Israel lost a bit of the momentum after that. And I mean, Billy was saying afterwards he was delighted with the scoreless draw. But then there was no time for any more friendlies because he had to go straight from Israel into the British Championship in May 1980, which was run over a week.
Incredible. So the three games in a week, was that how it was played?
Yeah, so all the tournament was played in a week. It started off on a Friday, and Northern Ireland, so Scotland were the visitors to Windsor Park. And that was probably a momentous occasion as well, because we had discussed previously that Northern Ireland hadn't been able to play at home from 1971 to 1975, and Yugoslavia were the first team to come back to Windsor. But even though England and Wales returned, Scotland had still refused to travel to Belfast, and Northern Ireland's home games against Scotland in 78 was played at Hampden. So in 1980, for the first time in 10 years, the Belfast crowd had a chance to see Scotland. And on a Friday night in Belfast, it turned out to be a momentous night. Billy Hamilton got the only goal, and Northern Ireland pulled off a famous win, because you had the likes of Graeme Souness, I think Alan Hansen was playing. There were some big names on that Scottish team, but it was a fully deserved win. Peter Weir had a very late chance to grab an equaliser, but Northern Ireland were deserving winners, and they ran out 1-0 winners, which was obviously a great start to the campaign.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's a fantastic start. And as you said, this Scottish team is absolutely stacked with top talent as well. Can you tell me, by the way, why were there matches not being played at home? Was it a security issue, or is just the ground wasn't available, or?
No, it was very much a security. So from 71 to 75, I think it was very much a security issue. They had to play home games in England. And I think it made sense that the Scotland game was played at Hampden. So Northern Ireland used Hampden for the Scotland game. I mean, it would have been financially made more sense. So in England, they moved around from Goodison Park to Bootbury Park in Hull to Highfield Road. I'm trying to think where else they played. They played at Fulham and Craven Cottage.
Wow.
so they moved around England quite a bit for different home games, but Scotland refused to come to Belfast. They decided it wasn't safe. So in 76 and 78, the games were played at Hampden. And so it was only 1980 that, as I said, they eventually went back.
Wow, incredible. And they went back to lose 1-0. As Northern Ireland took a huge victory as well. Just in that campaign as well, I seen that the next day Wales beat England 4-1. That seemed like a bit of a momentous scoreline.
Oh, absolutely. It was a sensational result. And England actually took the lead in that game. And but Wales came roaring back and actually absolutely hammered them 4-1 in Wrexham. And it was one of their greatest nights. And there's actually a story I tell about in Toulouse in 2016. So I'm with a friend of mine from Cork, and we were actually very sensible. We were at Wales beat Russia in Toulouse. And we actually did one thing very sensible. We said, we'll leave our phones, leave our wallets, and we'll go out for a couple of drinks in the early hours and enjoy ourselves and just bring cash. So we're in a bar with about 200 Welsh fans and chatting away, and the celebrations were going on. And I said, it has to be, to a group of them, your greatest win since you beat England 4-1. And they're looking at me and they said, no, and most of them were a lot younger than me. So we never beat England 4-1. And I said, you did in Wrexham. And I actually got one of the goal scorers. I thought it was an Emlyn Hughes own goal. It was actually Phil Thompson. But anyway, I said, you definitely did in Wrexham. And one of the guys, and I said, look, I appreciate I'm a bit older than you guys. What age was I at the time? 49. And the man says, well, I'm older than you, he says, and we didn't. I said, come on. So I didn't have my phone, but eventually one of them gets his phone out and he's right. So, but I thought it was very sad that people didn't actually know that, because it was one. I mean, I said it to some Welsh mates of mine actually from Wrexham who were there that day, and they were horrified that people didn't know that, you know. It was one of their great days, but it came totally out of the blue. It certainly wasn't expected. And if I remember correctly, I only saw the highlights. I don't think it was live, and it certainly wasn't live on TV in Ireland in those days. But Leighton James played out of his skin and absolutely destroyed England that day. But it was a great win for Wales. So a couple of surprise results on the opening couple of days. At Windsor, Scotland losing, and then England losing at Wrexham the following day. So that set up Northern Ireland's trip to Wembley on Tuesday, May 20th, 1980.
It's another great occasion, I think, for Northern Ireland as well. And I suppose you mentioned kind of, I suppose, in the other qualifications about Israel and, you know, snap your hand off for a point out there. They would absolutely have taken this result, surely, in a draw at Wembley.
Well, absolutely. And I mean, it was a fantastic result. But I think it has to be said it was a well-deserved result. I mean, even looking back at the stats, both teams had four efforts on goal. Northern Ireland played incredibly well. 9 minutes from time, England took the lead. It's down as an Noel Brotherston own goal, which is very unfortunate. He'd made his debut against Scotland and played incredibly well. And he scored an own goal with 9 minutes to go. And some of the British press were very uncomplimentary about him as a lost soul from Blackburn at the time. But 2 minutes later, Terry Cochran, the great Middlesbrough winger, came off the bench and nabbed an equaliser, but it was a fully deserved equaliser. And it left Northern Ireland in fantastic shape with a win and a draw at the top of the group, particularly when Scotland beat Wales at Hampden the following night.
Yeah, it shows a great deal of, I suppose, what you would probably expect in a Billy Bingham team, which is conviction and, you know, self-belief that, okay, we're 1-0 down at Wembley. You know, and to do it so quickly as well, the own goal happens on 81, and Cochrane scores, what, 83, 84? So it's a quick turnaround. They get themselves back into the game straight away when it could have been probably so easy to just go, ah, lads, you know, we're going to lose 1-0 away at Wembley.
Yeah, I mean, the heads didn't drop. And I mean, and even before that, they had taken the game to England. They hadn't just packed the defence. And we can go on in another podcast and talk about 85 and another trip to Wembley. But this one wasn't so much the backs to the wall. This was a well-earned point. It was a very good performance. And they took their game. Okay, sure, there were times when they had to defend. They had to rely on Jim Platt in goal as well. Pat Jennings and all the Arsenal players were missing, presumably because Arsenal were in the final of the Cup Winners' Cup. So it wasn't even a full-strength Northern Ireland team that went to Wembley and got an incredible 1-1 draw.
Absolutely, yeah. And then the following day, Scotland beat Wales, bring Wales back down to earth with a bit of a bump with a 1-0 win. And so Northern Ireland have to go to Cardiff to take on Wales then. Am I right in saying if Northern Ireland win, they win the championship?
Yes. So a win would have guaranteed the championship in Cardiff on that Friday night. And so we have talked before, but Northern Ireland hadn't won the home championship outright since 1914. So that was a long time. And it was also the centenary year of the IFA. It was a very momentous year. And to have the chance of winning the British Championship in Cardiff was pretty special. And a man who'd only come a little bit from nowhere, from Dundonald, to Noel Brotherston, put Northern Ireland ahead in 22 minutes. And I think it's fair to say it was certainly backs to the wall. And the second half seemed to drag on forever and ever. But eventually they got the final whistle and a very, very famous 1-0 win. And there were some celebrations. The game was also live on TV as well, which was a big thing. I don't think it was originally planned to be shown live, but with the championship at stake, people were able to watch it. And they certainly described Noel Brotherston's family back in Dundonald all watching the game.
And it's funny that he got the goal that won it is too, because as you mentioned, a couple of games ago, the English press had a bit of a field day with him as well, didn't they? So now he's laughing all the way to a championship.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, of course, people probably know the story. He sadly passed away from a heart attack at age 38. So sadly taken far, far too soon. But what a hero he was for Northern Ireland in 1980. And certainly that goal and that win will be remembered forevermore.
Absolutely, yeah. Footballing immortality has its upsides sometimes as well. And I suppose just to complete the set, England beat Scotland then at Hampden Park in what becomes a bit of a dead rubber then, because it doesn't matter.
England were on their way to the Euros in Italy, so it would have been used as a warm-up game, but from the point of view of the British Championship, it was a dead rubber.
So that's May 1980. So then we have to go straight back into the qualifiers for the 1982 World Cup. And they have to go away then to Sweden at the midpoint of June.
Well, I think we should talk about the test series in Australia.
These are a set of friendlies. How, why are they going to Australia?
Oh, it was a bit unusual, and sorry, I used the test series. It was actually written in the Australian press. So apologies for using the rugby term. I know it might wind some people up to post. What actually happened was in 1980, not only with the IFA having their centenary, but it was also the centenary of the Australian Federation. And they invited Northern Ireland. Obviously, it was before the invitation came, before they were British champions. But ideally, it worked out nicely for Australia because they arrived as British champions. Now, without a considerable number of players, I mentioned the Arsenal players hadn't been available. But they travelled. Now, in fairness, Australia in 1980 wouldn't be as strong in footballing terms, I suppose, as they are now. They had qualified for the 1974 World Cup, but they I think that was the only one they'd been to at that stage. But it was still an end-of-season tour. I don't know how seriously it was taken. But it was billed locally as a three-game test series with Northern Ireland travelling to Sydney, Melbourne and Adelaide and then actually going to the WACA in Perth for a tour game against Western Australia where caps wouldn't or weren't awarded. So it started off in Sydney in the Sydney Cricket Ground. Northern Ireland, Jimmy Nicol and John O'Neill had Northern Ireland two up either side of half time. Australia got a late goal back, but it was a good start, a win for Northern Ireland. And in game one, of which was certainly from the Australian perspective, seen as a rugby-style test series. And in fact, the Irish rugby team had gone a year earlier and won a test series in Australia. But anyway, a few days later, they went off to Melbourne, and it was a different story. Australia were ahead early on. They were probably the better team for a lot of the game. And Martin O'Neill grabbed a late equaliser with 8 minutes to go. And he would have gone to Australia, actually, having won the European Cup with Nottingham Forest in 1980 as well. So I said the Arsenal players missed out, but he still went there. Back to Adelaide for the third game, with Northern Ireland needing a draw to win the series. So they went to goal down again at halftime. So it was certainly very competitive games. That man, Noel Brotherston, scored again midway through the second half. And Linfield's Colin McCurdy, I don't think he got too many caps, but he got the winning goal with 13 minutes to go. And that saw Northern Ireland run out 2-1 winners and two wins and a draw from the international matches, which are obviously recorded as official internationals, caps awarded, part of the Australian centenary celebrations. So they finished the tour in Perth. So it was actually quite a lot of travelling in those days as well, because, I mean, if people who haven't been to Australia, Sydney to Perth is actually further to travel than Belfast to Moscow. So, but they did end up in Perth in the WACA, the famous cricket venue, and Northern Ireland ran out 4-0 winners over Western Australia select to complete the tour, which I think has to be considered a very successful tour.
Yeah, absolutely. And a wonderful kind of, I suppose, coincidence that they're both celebrating their centenary at the same time, and Northern Ireland are home nation champions as well. So it all kind of coincides for a very good kind of tournament as well, and it sounds like a pretty competitive one at that.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly going by. There isn't a lot of information. I've kind of dug up reports from the Australian side. I can't even get the goal scorers from the WACA, but there isn't a huge amount of information out there in the tour. But certainly, the games were very competitive. And the same, actually, I think the Australian goal scorer was the same guy whose name escapes me at the moment for the games. But certainly they were very close, and particularly in the second and third games, Australia had long spells where they were very competitive and maybe a little bit unfortunate to draw and lose in those games.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's interesting as well, in a country dominated by rugby and cricket and Aussie rules, etc., that they had a team out that was sounded like they were quite ready to take care of themselves from that point of view as well.
Yeah.
So we'll move on to I suppose back to the World Cup qualifying. Then the next match then after the tour is Sweden.
Well, yeah, so it was. So, but let's mention a couple of other games in the group that actually happened. So after Northern Ireland had drawn in Israel, there were a couple of key results involving Sweden, who were actually the second seed. So Northern Ireland were in a group with Scotland as top seeds. I mean, Scotland had been pretty much regulars at World Cups in that period. They qualified for 74 and 78. They were obviously going to go on and qualify for 82, 86, 90. They went to 98 as well. So Scotland were the top seeds. Sweden were actually the second seeds. They had played in 74, they'd also qualified in 78. Obviously, famously, he had reached the final in 58, finished third in 1950. So there was certainly a fine footballing pedigree there. And Portugal were the third seeds. So Northern Ireland were fourth seeds and not really expected to challenge too much. Couple of key results. Israel followed on from their excellent performance in March by going to Stockholm and earning a one-all draw with Sweden, a late equaliser, but key result, and it certainly damaged Sweden's prospects. And then in September 1980, Scotland went to Stockholm and beat Sweden 1-0. So it was a huge win for Scotland to kick off their campaign. Gordon Strachan with the only goal, 18 minutes from time. So Sweden were coming to Belfast in October 1980 in dire need of turning their campaign around. And for some reason, it was the centenary for the IFA, but they didn't, or maybe they weren't able to organise a glamour friendly. So they decided that the Sweden game, even though it was a World Cup qualifier, was also going to be their centenary game. And they had big celebrations. All the pageantry was around the qualifier against Sweden. And it was, well, it was also a huge night, a very successful night. Only 18,000 showed up for Windsor Park. So there was plenty of space. And even at this stage, despite being the first game back in Belfast as British champions on a win and the centenary game, it was actually a very disappointing attendance. But the losers were those that stayed away, because Northern Ireland started off on the front foot, yeah, and absolutely dominated the first half. Scored three goals in 13 minutes. That man, Noel Brotherson, again. And then Sammy McElroy and Jimmy Nicol, a Man United double. Two famous names from Man United in the 70s and early 80s. So they were 3-0 up at half-time. Sweden did come back into it a little bit in the second half, but their race was done. And that was an incredible win for Northern Ireland and left them in very good shape to qualify even at this early stage with two games gone.
Yeah. You mentioned the attendance there, only 18,000. Am I overstating it to say that, so we've talked about obviously the Republic of Ireland and at the time of Jack's kind of becoming manager, that international football hadn't taken over the imagination of the country, because, you know, there is probably little to shout about in terms of going to major championships. Are we kind of at that stage with Northern Ireland? They hadn't been to major championships in a while, and so maybe it hadn't sparked people into kind of going to Windsor Park, to go and watching games, and that they needed kind of perhaps this kind of qualification campaign to really ignite people's imaginations back into the international team.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think that's a fair comment. I mean, they did have the home championship, but if you go back into, let's say, the 60s, there would have been huge 40, 50,000 crowds at Windsor, particularly for the England games. But for the bigger games, now, I think we have to discuss the political situation, the troubles in Northern Ireland at the time. I mean, there was a safety element. I'm sure people on a Wednesday night, maybe it was easier to stay at home than to go out and possibly risk being shot. I mean, that was a fact of life. Now, I mean, life did continue on as normal, but I could imagine that maybe had an impact on some people's decision whether to go to a football match or maybe just to stay at home with the family. So it was that, and I mean, but it also was the fact that you say Northern Ireland hadn't been to a World Cup since 1958. At that stage, particularly going to the game against Sweden, it wasn't I don't know how realistic a possibility. It was certainly being mentioned, as it would, I suppose, at the start of every campaign. But it's hard to say how many people really believed that Billy Bingham was going to be the man at this stage. Obviously, the results in May had made a huge impression, and they were certainly fantastic results. But maybe after this performance and the win over Sweden, people were starting to believe.
Yeah, absolutely. And those attendances certainly would go up and up as the tournament went on, particularly for the final game as well at Windsor Park against Israel. But we continue on now to the rest of the qualification campaign as well. And so they're in a good position. They've got a cracking win against Northern Ireland. In their last podcast, we talked about Portugal as well, beating the Republic of Ireland, and we beat them 1-0 as well. But so Northern Ireland then have to go away to Portugal on the 19th of November in 1980.
Yeah, and I mean, Northern Ireland, I think it's important to say as well, went to Lisbon to the Stadium of Light on the back of a 9-game unbeaten run, which I think they certainly hadn't been on a run like that for many, many, many years. So if ever, actually, I don't know. But certainly it was a very impressive 9-game unbeaten run. And they lost 1-0, a goal 15 minutes after the break. But it was one of those probably unfortunate losses. They'd played really well. And as in Wembley, they'd taken the game to a more fancied opponent. They had chances. Portugal, in a spell of dominance, did nick the goal through Jordao. Northern Ireland had chances. Jerry Armstrong, I think, came close, but ultimately it wasn't to be, and Portugal earned a crucial 1-0 win. Now, it wasn't seen as fatal for the World Cup hopes, but certainly it was damaging, and it was disappointing.
Portugal then in their next game in December beat Israel 3-0. So have Portugal kind of managed to maybe wangle themselves a little bit into the picture back again?
Well, yeah, so Portugal, I mean, and they'd also drawn at Hampden in October on the same night Northern Ireland had beaten Sweden. So I think it would have been fair to say at that stage, Portugal, with the two wins and the draw, were in pole position, along with Scotland, to qualify. They certainly would have been the favourites at that stage.
So the next game up then is away for Northern Ireland at Hampden Park in Scotland. Before that, Scotland beat Israel away 1-0. So Northern Ireland have to go to Hampden Park. Is there pressure to get a result if they want to kind of stay in the frame, or do they kind of see it as a little bit of, you know, if we come out with something awesome?
Yeah, I think given that Portugal at that stage had two wins and a draw, and Portugal were coming to Belfast the following month, I think there was pressure to get a result. Now, and this is another one where it was very much a backs-to-the-wall performance. I mean, Scotland were a very strong team at that stage. They had some very talented players. They had big players like Graham Souness, who was one of the top midfield players in the world, said the likes of Alan Hansen, John Wark on a very talented Ipswich Town team, etc. Willie Miller on an Aberdeen team that had won the league in 1980 in Scotland. Alex McLeish, I mean, you can go on. There was a lot of names there that trip off the tongue for Scotland. It was a bit of a backs-to-the-wall performance, but Billy Hamilton scored, and he'd been the hero at Windsor a year earlier. So he put Northern Ireland into a shock lead on 70 minutes, very much against the run of play. Now, John Wark did grab an equaliser a few minutes later, but it was certainly seen as a crucial point, and it certainly put qualification back on the agenda and set up a huge game against Portugal a month later. I mean, Scotland were still looking very strong at that stage. They'd already got the crucial wins in Stockholm and Tel Aviv. But there were two places up for grabs, and it looked like it was between Northern Ireland and Portugal at that stage.
Mm. And they got that draw, that great draw, in front of nearly 78,500 people. So not an easy place to go, Hampden Park, and get a result, particularly at that time. Great players and huge attendances as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Talk to us a little bit. You said it a couple of times, and I wonder, is it something that Billy brought to the team as well, which is, you said kind of backs to the walls kind of stuff, you know, in a couple of the matches that we've talked about so far. Is it fair to say that there's probably more of a, and I don't mean it in a degrading way, but like there's more of a spine to this team. They're more prepared. They're better to attack a game. If they have to defend hard, they have to defend hard. And there's more investment in understanding that at times you're going to just have to play what's in front of you. And sometimes that means backs to the wall and hard defending.
Absolutely. Look, I mean, that was what certainly one thing that Billy instilled in the squad, that they were so well organized. Everybody fought for the jersey. And I mean, I talked about players like Noel Brotherston scoring crucial goals. He was a winger, but he worked so hard in defense. He did so much for the team. The likes of Jerry Armstrong, Billy Hamilton scored crucial goals up front. They were also back in their own penalty box, clearing balls away. There was no room for a striker. I mean, look, I don't mean to do this guy a disservice, but the likes of Ian Rush was one of the, if not the greatest Liverpool striker of all time, the greatest goal scorer and the greatest finisher. But he was very much, he was a goal scorer. He didn't do a lot else, though. Goals win games. Goals are so crucial. But if you have a team like Liverpool, and you can maybe afford that, and what a finisher he was. But the likes of Billy Hamilton or Jerry Armstrong couldn't afford to be that. Now, I appreciate they weren't in the class of finishing as in Ian Rush were, but they worked so hard at both ends of the field. They were back defending corners, defending free kicks, as well as being up front scoring goals. So the point I'm trying to make is the teams were so well organized. Everybody was fighting for the jersey. They had such a defense. You're talking about guys, John McClelland. I know he went on to be a star for Rangers, but he was at Mansfield Town at that stage playing defense. John O'Neill at Leicester. They had household names like Jimmy Nicol and Sammy McElroy, the likes of Man United, but they also had players like Tom Finney at Cambridge United. And they were, even Noel Brotherston at Blackburn, who wasn't very fashionable at the time. All these players were fighting for the jersey. They were playing out of their skin. And probably when they were playing at lower level in club football, they rose and they grew into the jersey at international level. Billy Bingham certainly deserves a lot of the credit for that.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And interesting, like I talked about it with Tony Galvin as well. You know, when, like, what he was saying was, you know, you have to kind of, because you don't have that many games in sense of a international football. So it kind of has to be a almost straightaway thing that you kind of get up to speed as to how you play international football. And that can be difficult for some players. And the players that make that work for them are the players that managers absolutely rely on their team. And even though they might not be playing brilliantly for their club, they almost automatically go into the international team because the manager knows, I know you can do a job for me. Very much similar to Jack and his team.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, there are a lot of similarities. And
100%, yeah.
He had everybody playing for the jersey, and players who, I think, without being disrespectful, in their club career were very much journeyman players, were suddenly, they put on a green shirt and they were superstars and they were heroes. And this is for another podcast. We can go on and talk about the World Cup finals, but certainly even to get to win British Championship in 1980, to get to the World Cup, players had to play out of their skin.
Absolutely. Yeah. Teamwork, teamwork, teamwork. That's what it's all about if you want to win things. One fantastic 1-1 draw with Scotland away. Scotland beat Israel 3-1. So Scotland are pretty much solidifying their kind of grip on the group. Northern Ireland then have Portugal at home, which must have been a huge game considering the way the group was looking at the time.
It was must win. It was a huge game, but it was also must win with the defeat in Lisbon in November. We were halfway through the campaign at this stage, and Portugal were in very good shape. So came to Belfast. The weather wasn't great. There was a swirling wind, probably maybe suited Northern Ireland, but they played incredibly well. I mean, Malcolm Brody singled out three players in particular. Jimmy Nicol had the game of his life, and Billy Hamilton and Jerry Armstrong worked so hard up front and at the back. And it was one of those days. Northern Ireland were the better team, but the goal never seemed to come. And I mean, I think it's fair to say, I mean, we talked about 3-0 wins over Sweden and all that, but it's fair to say there was a goal scoring problem considered maybe at that stage. There was a few games where it had toiled to break teams down or to put the ball in the net. But with 15 minutes to go, Billy Hamilton knotted one down, and Jerry Armstrong got the crucial goal to win the game.
A huge win at Windsor Park for Northern Ireland. They have to go away to Sweden, and then Sweden have to play Portugal. So Sweden become, I suppose, very impactful on these between Northern Ireland and Portugal and their runs.
Yeah, so, I mean, at this stage, Sweden were probably considered kind of out of it. Mm-hmm. Their home draw with Israel, lost at home to Scotland, hammered in Belfast. And Northern Ireland went to Sweden, at least hoping for a point and probably expecting a point. Sweden were probably considered out of it. It was a bad. It was June 1981, and it was one of those bad days. And the headline the following day in the newspaper was "The Dream Dies, the World Cup is Over," because a Hasborg penalty 5 minutes after the break won the game 1-0 for Sweden. Northern Ireland did not play well. Terry Cochrane was sent off. He was the first Northern Ireland player since George Best and Sofia to be sent off. It was just a bad, bad night all around. Nothing seemed to go right, and a very disappointing defeat. And with only two games to go, it wasn't looking good. The table did not look good for Northern Ireland.
It seems like a bit of a dramatic turn to say your World Cup's hope were dashed when clearly you're still in with a decent chance of qualifying if results kind of you can turn results your way.
Yeah, I mean, so the games left were Scotland at home and Israel at home. And I think it's probably fair to say that two wins would have put, at that stage, would have put Northern Ireland on 10 points. Now, Portugal had quite a few games left. They had Sweden to play twice. They had Israel as well to play. So, and a home game against Scotland. So it certainly Portugal were in the driving seat. But yeah, it is a little bit harsh to say they were dashed, but certainly they weren't. Northern Ireland wouldn't have been favourites to qualify. So the 4th of June 1981, it wasn't looking too good, but then things did turn around.
Yeah, so Sweden beat Portugal then. Now all of a sudden Sweden are in the frame to perhaps qualify ahead of everybody else. So then Scotland beat Sweden, so that puts another stick in the spokes.
Yeah.
so it's very nip and tuck, and it's quite close then when Northern Ireland have to host Scotland at Windsor Park. It's essentially, I would imagine, do absolutely under any circumstances do not lose this game.
Yeah, it was a must not lose, but it was at that stage, at the kickoff, certainly was also seen as a must win. Later, I think it was later that night, Portugal were playing Sweden.
That's right.
And I think it's crucial to say it was later that night. I mean, Scotland needed a draw to qualify for Spain. Northern Ireland needed a win to be seen to have a realistic chance. And I mean, they played really well, and certainly justifiable penalty shouts according to the unbiased press. But Willie Miller was meant to have chopped down Billy Hamilton, but the Russian referee waved it away. And Northern Ireland played really well, just couldn't get the goal. We maybe go back to the old goal-scoring problem. But Jock Stein's Scottish side, they held out for the point they needed. And Billy Bingham was quoted afterwards saying, "We won the battle but lost the war." So they probably feel like they should have won the game, but it wasn't to be enough. And even the newspaper reports, interestingly, the next day, which were written before the result came through from Lisbon. I think that's crucial, because Portugal were hosting Sweden, did seem to say the dream seems to have died. But of course, from Malcolm Brody and Jimmy Dubois, etc., filing their reports, matters were happening in Lisbon that had a huge effect on the group.
Yeah, absolutely. A massive game between Portugal and Sweden. And Sweden just do it in the end, don't they?
Yeah, so Sweden, I mean, which was a brilliant result for Northern Ireland, it was their last game of the campaign, to leave them on 8 points, a point ahead of Northern Ireland, but who was still a game in hand. Sweden got a last-minute winner to beat Portugal in Lisbon in the Stadium of Light, an incredible win for Sweden. A huge kick in the teeth for Portugal. Mm. It wasn't actually seen as fatal for their chances, because they still had to play Israel and Scotland. But it was a big blow for them, and it certainly put qualification back on for Northern Ireland. But they needed a favour from Israel later that month.
Am I right in saying it's still if it's deadlocked, it's head to head, not goal difference? Am I right in saying?
No, it would have been goal difference.
Oh, would have been goal
difference.
Days. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So then Portugal have to go away to Israel, and it's basically here for Portugal is, I suppose, the summation of a bit of a going off the rails for them in the final couple of games of their final number of games of their group stage.
Yeah, so I mean, I think it's fair to say on the morning of the 14th of October 1981, Portugal were in the driving seat. They were, I think it was on 5 points, but with three games to go, they would have been confident to beating Sweden, confident to beating Israel, and then they had Scotland at home to set up qualification. And but definitely, they went to Tel Aviv, and Billy Bingham went to Tel Aviv as well to get a look at Israel. And I mean, it was described as being a bit of a crazy game. I mean, Israel went ahead very early on. Portugal equalised in the 8th minute. But I mean, Israel were 4-1 up after half an hour, and it was one of those games where nobody was able to defend. And it was a huge shock result. I mean, I remember certainly at the time being gobsmacked that Israel would have put 4 goals past Portugal by the 30th minute of the game. And I mean, it wasn't, I suppose Israel was still a little bit of an unknown quantity in Europe at that stage, but it certainly was a huge, huge shock, and a fantastic result for Northern Ireland, because it left qualification in Northern Ireland's hands. Mm. And it meant they only needed a draw at home to Israel a few weeks later. But the one thing Billy Bingham did say after the game in Tel Aviv was, he has had a warning from Israel that these guys are good. And I mean, I think it was fair to say the Northern Ireland had been a little fortunate to escape in March 1980 with a point. But Windsor Park in November is a very different prospect to Tel Aviv in March.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. So Portugal lose against Sweden, lose at home against Sweden, and lose away then to Israel. So their kind of championship has kind of fallen off the rails in a big way before the final games on the 18th of November 1981. So, as we mentioned at the start of this campaign, Windsor Park had 18,000 people or so in the first game, first home game at Windsor Park. There's 38,000 packing into Windsor Park to see if Northern Ireland can go to a World Cup. So the place is hopping, the fans are in. Can Northern Ireland do the job?
Yeah, so as I said, only a draw now was needed. Northern Ireland were on 7 points, Sweden were on 8, Portugal were gone, Scotland were already in Spain, or they'd punched their ticket. So if Northern Ireland drew or won, they went to Spain, and if they lost, to Israel, then Sweden went to Spain. Northern Ireland had a better goal difference than Sweden, so a draw, that's why a draw would have been enough. And, well, it was an absolutely crucial night in Belfast. As you say, 38,000 packed in, and they all went home happy. The only goal in the 27th minute, which calmed the nerves a bit, a Jimmy Nicol free kick, was pumped into the box. Billy Hamilton nodded it down, and Jerry Armstrong shot home with his left foot on the 27th minute. It was the only goal of the game, crucial game. A famous night in Windsor Park, maybe one of the most famous nights ever. And it was job done. Israel never really threatened. Northern Ireland were nervy but comfortable, and it was a huge win and job done. Qualification for Spain.
Absolutely incredible. And who would have thought at the, I suppose, at the start of 1980 that they'd be heading to a World Cup and British Home Nations tournament winners as well. It seemed like such a fireplace to be, but here they were after what, less than 2 years under Billy Bingham, doing extraordinary things as a team. It really is a fantastic turnaround.
Oh, it's an incredible turnaround. I mean, if you take it from March 1980 to November 1981, they qualified for a World Cup and won a first home championship for 66 years.
I'm guessing by the attendance at the end of the and in the last game at Windsor Park that all of a sudden this has sparked the imagination of Northern Ireland fans, and they are coming to realise that there might just be something a little bit special about this team.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there had been back page news, but certainly having beaten Israel, it was front page news as well. It was huge celebrations. All the politicians across the political divide, they all got in on the act with the celebrations, and it was a huge deal. And even south of the border, I certainly remember it was a big deal in our papers, in our media as well, that Northern Ireland qualifying. And I suppose there wasn't the rivalry in those days. Back in 1982, there was certainly 81, 82, there was certainly general support for them, and general support across the community in Northern Ireland as well. Even though the troubles were going on, there were it'll be another podcast when we talk about the finals, but there were street parties for the World Cup, separate street parties, mind you, but still, I mean, it was seen very much as being a team from all of Northern Ireland. I mean, you had the likes of Pat Jennings, Jerry Armstrong, Mal Donaghy from the Martin O'Neill from the nationalist community, as well as those heroes from the unionist community as well. So it was very much a cross-community team with cross-community support. And it was a huge celebration for everybody in November 1981 when they got to they qualified for the World Cup.
Yeah. And I think as well, I know we keep saying it, but I think that was the character of Billy as well, is in that he didn't want the national team to look like it was just this kind of one side over here who was making all the... He wanted everybody to be a part of it. I don't care where you're from, what part of Northern Ireland you're from, where you live in Belfast, wherever. Come, play, do your best, and that's how we all succeed.
Yeah, and absolutely. And I mean, I think in November 93, and I am jumping forward a bit, he did get some... very bad press this side of the border, and people were making comments like Billy Bigot and thing. And I mean, they're just so wrong and so unfair. And anybody who worked with the man would say they were just so untrue. I mean, he made Martin O'Neill his captain. Jerry Armstrong, I mean, was one of the all-time heroes. He scored so many crucial goals, not just in Windsor Park, but in Valencia. And Pat Jennings in goal, I mean, one of the legendary heroes. So Billy was by no means a bigot or anything like that, and he was an incredible man, an incredible manager. He knew how to organize a team, how to get everybody playing for him, and it was such a successful team and such a successful period. And look, I'm naming some of the legends of Northern Ireland football, the absolute legends. And I mean, I'm going to forget some, but the likes of Pat Jennings, Jimmy Nicol, Sammy McElroy, David McCreary, Mal Donaghy, Billy Hamilton, Jerry Armstrong, Martin O'Neill. Tommy Cassidy was a huge player in that campaign, the British Championship win. Even the likes of Tom Finney, Noel Brotherston from Blackburn, Tom Finney from Cambridge, John McClelland from Mansfield. He was playing for Northern Ireland from Mansfield Town. And Mansfield Town were a smaller team then as they are now. So you're talking about many of the legends there, but Billy Bingham was the man who brought it all together, and he made a team, and he made many of them out to be superstars as well. So I think that does need to be said. And I think it's unfortunate in some of the events to transpire in his last game that he does get some bad press here.
Yeah, and I would probably put myself in that category too. I think my view of him and who he was probably quite tainted by what happened that night, and my own opinions. And only doing research for this podcast and reading up on him and the players' opinions about him, etc., I kind of realized that my own opinions were probably quite wrong, and quite the opposite. He seemed like the kind of person that really did want an all-inclusive team, and perhaps that night emotions perhaps got the better of him as well, and some of the things that he was doing too. It was his last game. He didn't want it to go down as a loss, or certainly he wanted to you know, stop us from going to World Cup, etc. You know, there was probably a bit miffed that they had gotten a bit of shellacking from us earlier in the campaign in Dublin too. So perhaps I revised my own opinion on who he was and what he was like as a person.
Yeah, and I mean, we talked about how good a manager he was and how much he organized the team, but it's also his own pride in that team, and he was doing his best for Northern Ireland. And even that night in November, I mean, there was a lot of stuff. They were humiliated in Dublin in March 93. It was 3-0. It could have been any score. Fans were singing "One Team in Ireland," etc. Then there was a lot of talk and a lot of efforts to move the game from November 93. I know Munich was being talked about and everything. That did not go down well in Northern Ireland. I think the fact that it was such a crucial game for the Republic, and the whole country was watching, not just the football fans. I mean, the TV figures were off the charts. Everybody was watching the game. It mattered so much. And a lot of people expected Northern Ireland, well, it doesn't matter to you, so you'd rather we qualified in Denmark and just go through the motions and let us win. And there are still people to this day, and I still meet Danish fans who believe that actually did happen, right?
I'd advise them to go watch that match back. They gave us not an inch.
Exactly. But I mean, what I would say is, if Northern Ireland were playing Denmark for us to qualify, they would have played out of their skins as well. And I mean, okay, sure, I'm sure it mattered to some of their fans, and they would have loved to have denied us a place in the World Cup. There's no question they were singing "You're Not Going to the USA" at 1-0. But I mean, it's from Billy Bingham's perspective, he was putting out his team to do a job. And look, it does irk me a little bit, and I've seen it. I mean, I'll use an example maybe that most people would not be familiar with, but from a Limerick perspective, back in 2008, we were playing Shelburne on the last day. They needed a win to win the league. Limerick played out of their skins, got a 92nd minute equaliser to deny Shelburne the title and give the title to Dundalk. And I mean, there were Shelburne fans going nuts after that game, saying, "Oh, you sent the keeper up for the corner," and everything like that. And I mean, we did our best. I mean, that's all you can ask. And I mean,
that's the nature of the game, isn't it?
It's the nature of the game. And ironically, 2 weeks earlier, Limerick had gone to Oriel Park and beaten Dundalk to put the title in Shelburne's hands. I won't mention some of the other performances, which were absolutely shocking, which is the reason they were nowhere in the mix, so in mid-table. But they gave everything, which is, I mean, you have to be fair, it was a nothing game for Limerick. But in this case, it was a nothing game for Northern Ireland. But it was Billy Bingham's last game, and it was still an international match, and these players had pride in the jersey. And I think it's a little bit disingenuous to expect any team to lie down and let another team win, which I think a lot of that was the cause of a lot of the angst and the bad press, which Billy unfortunately gets even to this day, south of the border. And I mean, you ask any players like Pat Jennings, like Gerry Armstrong, like Martin O'Neill, players from a nationalist background that played for him, and they were all, Mal Donaghy, they would have run through a brick wall for him, just as much as your Sammy McElroy's, your David McCreary's, your Billy Hamilton's, your John McClellan's, your Tommy Cassidy's, etc. They were all players, anyone who played for Billy Bingham would have run through a brick wall for him.
Absolutely, yeah. And as they say, our wee country, take pride in the jersey every time you put it on. And he certainly gave that to Northern Ireland. So they are off to España, 1982, where they would make their own little pieces of history while they were there as well. But that, as we always say, is a podcast for another day. Gary, as ever, fantastic. Always great to get some wonderful insights and talk about these great teams. And this was certainly a great period for Northern Ireland football. And we will certainly cover them and their Spanish adventure in the coming podcast as well on the show. As ever, Gary, thank you very much.
Cheers. Thanks, Kevin.
Well, that's it for this week's show. My thanks to our resident football historian and fan, Gary Spain. Don't forget to share the show on your social media channels to let more people find out about the history and heritage of Irish football. Turn on notifications on whatever podcast platform you use so that you can get notified straight away when a new episode drops. And remember, support your local League of Ireland and Northern Ireland Football League team. It's our history, it's our game. Bye for now.